From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll tell you about a summit for men of color happening this weekend and what organizers hope to accomplish. NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday host, Aisha Roscoe, talks about her new book of essays written by HBCU alumni, including herself.
In this book, you have this testimony, and that's what I look at it as. It's really a testimony to the worth and why HBCUs matter.
Plus, the owner of the Lao barbecue restaurant, Sap Sap, talks about his decision to move away from a brick and mortar and what's next for his business.
I legit got burnt out. Towards the end of it, I was like, this is not working. I'm not happy. I felt like I lost my passion, and I just really needed to take a break and reassess everything and figure out what was best for the future of Sap Sap.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Like Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. UW-Madison will host a summit this weekend designed to create community for men of color. It's a student-led initiative, and organizers hope by sharing experiences, knowledge, and resources, it will inspire and empower all men of color to embrace their unique identities and thrive in their personal and professional lives. WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, spoke with three of the event's organizers. All three are men of color. They are second-year MBA students at UW-Madison School of Business, and they all share a passion for creating space and resources for marginalized people.
The event's official title is Empowering Men of Color, Navigating the Path to Self-Actualization. What does that mean?
Yeah, thank you. My name is Dries Amara. The thought behind it was, so in thinking about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and oftentimes for men of color or just marginalized people in general, we, for whatever reason, tend to not have our most basic of needs met. That can be for a variety of different reasons, right? And so, and because of that, I think that that impacts our ability to actually show up and be our most authentic selves, or show up in a space that we, you know, in a way in which that we want to be who we truly are. And so, I think it's just very important to be able to recognize and understand that without having those most basic of needs met, you're not able to actually thrive and be who you want to be. And so that I think really just shifting the perspective to understand, you know, why is it that we can't, are overlooking the most, those most basic of things. And so I guess a change in the perception around how we think about how we take care of ourselves and how we meet our most basic of needs so we can show up and actually be who we want to be to thrive.
Why is this summit happening at this particular moment? Do you think there are specific conversations that need to be happening right now with men of color on the campus? Is it seeing what's happening in the world that you wanted to create this space right now? Why is this happening right now?
I think I can maybe jump in, and Ibrahim and Dries, please feel free to add your own perspective. My name is Elliot Nardi. For me, coming in and being a part of the Wisconsin School of Business, I've met fantastic folks, made great connections, have been able to work with Ibrahim, Dries, members of the committee for planning this summit. But something that continues to stick out to me is, while I was a first-generation student to go to undergrad, first-gen to go to grad, I'm using this grad opportunity to pivot my career into something new. But something that's always in the back of my head is representation matters. And so UW-Madison is a PWI. It's a predominantly white institution. Myself, Ibrahim, Dries are one of just a handful of men of color in our program. And so while we connect with each other very quickly, there hasn't been a lot of opportunity to see where, to see ourselves in people in professional roles in the future coming back. There's just not a lot for us to go off of. So while we can support ourselves as we try to navigate through this, looking to the future, it's a little stark, at least for me and in my experience of like what I could look to aspire to. Mixed that with what is going on in the rest of the world. George Floyd protests, the COVID pandemic. There are events that have happened on campus around Mifflin. Last year, there was a big blow up of one of the undergraduate students and her relationship with an African-American individual that caused protests on campus, and just seeing how The other men of color in the program, other men of color that I know on campus were affected in comparison to the majority of campus. And in some cases, the lack of support that went towards the affected men of color was just really eye-opening. It's like, hey, we can have each other's backs, and there's not many of us. So how can we get together and help support and uplift? And then to Dries's kind of bringing up the theme of the summit, that hierarchy means how do we get past the basic levels of Maslow's hierarchy, the physiology, the safety, love and belonging, and get past that to self-actualizing and being where we want to be and being who we want to be, instead of just kind of focusing on those bottom levels. And how can we support each other through that path?
I'll jump in very briefly. I think that there is a persistent effort to remove DEI initiatives in the corporate context as well as higher education. And so with that said, this conference is absolutely necessary, right? It's just to reinforce the importance of young men of color who are aspiring professionals, you know, who want to, aspire to higher professional things. And so bringing this conference together is absolutely necessary to re-emphasize their value and their importance. And I'll just quickly share that. I think it's always important to be talking about the relevance of men of color. We have a variety of different experiences, right? We're not a monolith, right? We come from different backgrounds and we experience different things in our own way. And so to be able to bring together men of different experiences to just talk about that diversity within itself, I think is just very much necessary and important at this particular time.
You definitely make a good point about the, I'll call, attacks on DEI right now. And it probably is making people a lot more fearful or concerned, like, is there going to be spaces for people of color going forward? What are you hoping the attendees get out of the event?
I think for me, one of the biggest things, and maybe the most, my hope for like the primary, like the first thing that happens is just keying back to that representation matters. This summit is intentionally intergenerational. We're working from high school students all the way through alumni and professional, and just wanting to be able to say, hey, you might be one of three, one of five, one of one men of color in your program, in your classes, in your office. But there are people that are either ahead of you down the timeline in their professional career or coming up behind you in their academic and professional career. And like, there are other folks that look like you, that share similarities that you, but also have differences. And can you connect with those folks? Can you visualize yourself along their path, along a similar path? And I think just getting 200 men of color in the same room is a win in and of itself. And the things that will come from that, I think will be really great and really powerful. But I think that's the first thing, is just getting everybody in that shared space with a shared mindset.
I think this is one of those spaces that will allow really all of us to really build that type of community, to really have that type of impact on one another. It's not as easy to kind of bring a crowd like this together inside the community. And so being able to have the center, have the space, and also just have the voices to really reach one, teach one, really guide each other along this journey with our unique identities, experiences as men of color. That was kind of the passion, the impetus of really pushing me to make this happen. I'm hoping that folks also come out with just a new sense of like wanting to practice vulnerability. I'm really hoping that throughout the conference, folks are able to really dive into these conversations, kind of share their experiences, be heard, and also listen to other folks. And I hope that people are able to come out of here understanding the power of vulnerability and kind of using that to maybe help make others open or kind of other men share out. Which goes to kind of my larger thing. I hope that folks are able to, think about their mental health in connection to their identity a little bit more. I hope that people are able to like prioritize or destigmatize kind of what they need in order to really exist and be resilient and really affirm themselves and how their identity impacts their lives.
I just wanted to quickly add, I totally agree with the vulnerability piece. And I think for me, the biggest hope is that the diverse men of color who do show up, I think learn that they don't have to live up to what society's expectations are of men of color. Like they should be able to, you know, just live their life in whatever way that they think is right and fit for them. I think a lot of the hierarchical structures that we experience in men of color, you know, that often in time that impacts like our psyche, our confidence and whatnot. And so I think that I'm hoping that men of color can just walk away from this and be confident in living their life, you know, how they want to and whatever way that is.
So this conference happens. It's successful. Good vibes, good conversations. Everybody's feeling motivated. But I want to know what happens next in you guys' minds.
Yeah, I can touch on this a little bit and then I'll let Dries and Elliot come in. But yeah, we've been talking about the sustainability of this for as long as I feel like we've been talking about the creation of this. And so as we've kind of been working with our partners and sponsors, we've also been trying to think about, one, how can we just get more funding so that whoever kind of takes this project on next has to do like less of the heavy lifting. We've also been thinking about how we can like pull our sponsors together to maybe even make an exec board so that this is also sustained, but still having kind of students be in charge. And so, yeah, we haven't really ironed out what's next, but we've definitely been kind of strategizing around how we can make it happen.
As Ibrahim said, I think we have been trying to be really conscious since we started. And like Ibrahim came to us with the notion of creating the summit of how do we not only create the summit, what do we need to do that, but how do we do it in a way that is sustainable and setting a foundation for following summits, for next year's summit, the year after that, the year after that. One of those big things is being in constant communication with our sponsors and letting them know that we would like to create some type of exec board that would oversee it. We would like to continue the partnerships with them into the future years and help build this together. And then also kind of building into the summit and the day of itself, hoping that it's a great experience for a lot of the attendees, but then also letting those attendees know like, hey, we are looking to hand this off. We're going to be graduating. Folks will be going across the country to start their new professional careers. And we need students to come in. Hopefully you had a great experience at the Men of Color Summit. Hopefully you leave having felt empowered, wanting to do things, and that you have ideas for what it could look like for next year. And then hopefully bring those folks in after the summit wraps and start working through the handoff. So really hoping that it can be much more polished and just can continue to grow and develop in the future.
Yeah, I'll just quickly add. So considering that the University of Wisconsin-Madison is improving its efforts to recruit diverse students, how can this summit bleed into the culture of the school, right? Like even beyond the summit part, like how does this summit itself, like how can it potentially influence like the culture of the school where people actually feel, you know, psychological safety and belonging within the school, the context of the school?
Well, I want to thank you guys so much for having this conversation with me about the summit. I just wish you all good luck.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Karen.
That was WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, speaking with the organizers of the upcoming Men of Color Summit, Ibrahim Abubakar, Elliot Nardi, and Dries Amara. The event is this Saturday at the Pyle Center on UW-Madison's campus. HBCUs, or historically black colleges and universities, have a rich history in the United States. Many were founded during a time when black Americans were barred from other higher education institutions. Today, HBCUs continue to provide black students with community, support, and mentorship while they explore career paths. Aisha Roscoe is the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday and the Saturday episode of Up First. Her new book, HBCU Made, A Celebration of the Black College Experience, is a collection of essays from people like Stacey Abrams, Branford Marsalis, and Oprah Winfrey reflecting on their time at HBCUs. WUWM's Eric Vaughn Fellow, Nadia Kelly, is joined by Roscoe to talk about putting the book together and her HBCU experience at Howard University in Washington, D.C.
First of all, what initially sparked this idea of bringing all these people together in your collection to reflect on their HBCU experiences?
Well, I wish I could say that it was like completely my idea and I was like, yes, let's bring this together. But actually, Algonquin reached out to me and they said, we want to bring together a collection of essays from HBCU graduates because this really hasn't been done before, like with a major publishing company. And I was shocked. I couldn't believe that this was something that hadn't really been done. It just seems like it should have been done, you know, a long time ago. And so when they brought it to me, I was like, you know, I would love to take this on, even though I have like a million things going on. I was like, you know, because going to Howard University was such a pivotal point in my life and really life changing and life altering, I was like, I really have to do this because I want to give back to an institution that gave so much to me, and because I do believe in the power of HBCUs. And so I'm so glad to be able to bring HBCU Made into the world.
There's such a wide range of perspectives here in the book. Was there any new insight that you gained about the HBCU experience? I know you went to Howard, but in reading and editing these essays, was there any new insight that you gained about the HBCU experience?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I learned so much. Like, I was shocked by how much in each of the stories, in different ways, you could see how the HBCU experience is really an experience about community and connection. And you see it in stories like Tendai Kumba, who is a Spelman graduate and a Broadway dancer and singer, who got into a bad accident when she was at Spelman. And it was her Spelman community that really rallied around her and told her, you're going to be able to dance again. And she was, and she is. And with Roy Wood Jr., the way that, you know, he got in trouble when he was at FAMU, and he's talked about this. He talks about this in the essay, but it was FAMU that gave him a second chance. And so you see like this community and redemption. But I also just learned a lot of stuff about HBCUs that I didn't know about, like Spelman and like all their traditions and how they wake the freshmen up at like, you know, 4 a.m. and have them in the chapel singing and all this. I didn't know anything about that. So like all of these traditions I learned about. And like, you know, as a Howard grad, you know, I know about Howard, but reading about the other schools, I was like, oh, this is, you know, I can see why people love these schools. I can see why people feel so connected.
And when you went to Howard, were there any traditions that you really look fondly back on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love being on the yard, which is like, you know, the main courtyard of the school. You would, especially like on like when springtime came and the sun was out and everybody would be just, you know, on there trying to look good, trying to impress. You always had the sororities and fraternities. They had their, you know, special trees that were painted for them that, you know, you don't go around, you know, if you're not one of them, but they would be like strolling. And it always felt magical. And I write about it in the book how I, you know, when I did my campus tour, it was on a Friday, and it was kind of drizzly and rainy, but, you know, I saw like the Delta strolling and I saw all of these beautiful Black people on the yard. And that's when I knew, like, I got to go there. Howard is home.
You say you write about being at Howard, and you also write about working as a staff writer and eventually an editor in chief at their newspaper, The Hilltop. And you say that you got this piece of advice to put more bass in your voice. Could you explain what that means, first of all, to anyone who doesn't know? And how has this advice helped you since graduating from Howard?
Yeah, you know, and actually it was Shawnee Hilton who went on to be a very famous journalist in her own right. But yeah, she was a departing senior, and she said, you know, you should put a little more bass in your voice. And what she meant by that was just that I should kind of stand in my own authority and my own power and embrace that and not be so timid. and unsure. And really, it was about just being able to know that I am worthy and I have opinions that matter, and that I'm in a spot because I deserve it. And just kind of walking in that. And so I say in the introduction, I didn't learn it right then. I couldn't really take it in right at that moment, right? But over time, I think I've been able to hear that and receive that. Those seeds that were planted, they've been watered, and I've been able to grow into the person that you see now, and into a person that can stand in my power and in my authority.
When you went to Howard, did that help you become connected to other Black journalists or Black writers that came before you? And if so, how?
Yeah, you know, I think that it definitely helped me in the sense that, like, first of all, Howard has such a rich collection of, you know, journalists who have come through Howard. And so those connections helped me. But really, it was like the professors. Like, I had a professor and mentor, Yannick Rice Lamb, who was like the editor-in-chief of Heart and Soul, that magazine. I'm sure a lot of people remember it from back in the day. But like, she, I learned so much from her. Philip Dixon was over the print journalism department at that time. And he was like a legendary journalist from Philadelphia who worked at, I believe, the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Washington Post. And so, like, you know, I learned so much from them, and they poured so much into me. And really, and I will always say this, Howard is the reason why I got my first job in journalism at Reuters. It was a Howard business reporting class. They partnered with Reuters, and it was through that class that Reuters even, you know, learned about me. I would have never gotten an internship at Reuters without that class, because I'd only had one prior internship. Everyone else had, you know, interned at every place under the sun. So it is really Howard that put me on the path that I am now.
What do you hope that people, whether it's someone who's looking to go to an HBCU or someone who maybe doesn't even know that much about Black colleges in general, like, what do you hope that people take out of reading your book?
What I feel like people can get from this book, you know, which has, you know, stories from Stacey Abrams, Oprah Winfrey, Roy Wood Jr., as I said, Branford Marsalis, and others, in their own words, I think what you get is the richness of the HBCU experience. So even if you've gone to an HBCU, there's things that you can learn. If you don't know much about HBCUs, you can learn about what this experience is all about. What's the hype all about? This is what it's about. This is why Beyonce was doing Homecoming. And then also, I think, you know, I always look at it like, this is like if you went to a homecoming on some campus and you pulled five or six people to the side from different generations and said, why are you here? Why does this matter? These are the type of stories you would hear. And so not everybody's going to be able to get to do those interviews or do the campus tour. But in this book, you have this testimony. And that's what I look at it as. It's really a testimony to the worth and why HBCUs matter.
Aisha Roscoe is the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday and the author and editor of the new book, HBCU Made. She spoke with WUWM's Eric Vaughn fellow, Nadia Kelly. You can find more about Roscoe's book at WUWM.com. In about 15 minutes, we'll hear from an author about how birding changed how she views and interacts with the environment.
I don't think rage and fear are sustainable fuels. I've burned out, many people burned out, and I discovered that birds for me were sustainable fuel for my soul.
But first, the owner of the restaurant Sap Sap shares how his business is changing. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There's a new pop-up in town. The chef behind SapSap is serving up Lao barbecue all over southeastern Wisconsin. Chef Alex Hanasakta moved to Milwaukee last summer after closing his Mount Pleasant restaurant after 2 years. Now, SapSap will focus on private dinners, events, and pop-ups, dishing up items like brisket fried rice, lemongrass chicken wings, and house-made Lao sausage. Hanasakta joins WUWM's Lena Tran to talk about his next phase of SapSap, which the chef is calling Uban.
You closed SapSap, the brick and mortar, last summer, and now you've been running SapSap Uban as a pop-up, doing like barbecues and pho and private dinners. How'd you get to this current phase?
Long story short, we decided to close down a restaurant in Racine and kind of just go back to our old model, which was popping up in other restaurants in other cities. We figured, you know, before the restaurant that was working for us, that was fun.
Yeah. Mm. Why was it the right time to say goodbye to the restaurant?
Racing was difficult. One, you know, the business model in general, it's tough for restaurants. Restaurants in general deal with a lot. And for me, like, I felt like I lost my passion for cooking just because of the daily grind of the restaurant. You know, dealing with customers, staff. I legit got burnt out. And towards the end of it, I was like, this is not working. I'm not happy. I felt like I lost my passion. And I just really needed to take a break and kind of reassess everything and figure out what was best for the future of SapSap.
How are you feeling now?
I feel good. I feel really good. I mean, kind of feel like there's a new, we're starting from scratch, but again, we're revisiting that old pop-up model that always worked for us, and it was always fun, and I feel like this spreads our brand a little more and kind of gets our story out there.
You named the project Uban. Can you talk about what that means to you?
Yeah, so Uban is it's a refugee camp I was born in after my mother and father escaped Laos from the secret war. Uban was a refugee camp that most of the Lao people stayed in, one of them anyways. And yeah, I was born there. And this is kind of like a homage to, the upbringing where I was conceived and my mom's story and kind of like the story of Lao refugees, but not even just Lao refugees, but refugees in general.
So what can people expect from Uban events and pop-ups?
Yeah, so I mean, the whole idea behind Uban is just like Southeast Asian style barbecue. I know it's a little different, but really just like a lot of smoky grilled meats, renditions on certain American classics, but ultimately like the flavors of Southeast Asia in a smoker.
You cannot beat grilled smoked meats with a sticky rice for sure.
No, you can't, no. The main staples are obviously a lot of protein. We're really protein heavy. Growing up, my parents would always barbecue in the backyard. And, you know, it pairs with sticky rice and other hot sauces from Laos and Southeast Asia. But that was the idea, grilled smoky meats with sticky rice. But yeah, I mean, we want to definitely like offer more options, right? Like we're going to do a rendition on a banh mi, which is a Vietnamese sandwich. But we're going to do like a smoked brisket banh mi out of it. We do a smoked brisket fried rice right now. But just keeping it really simple, you know, no bells and whistles, just really delicious comfort food. Some of it is fusion. I hate that word, but, you know, but yeah, it's really just really basic, simple, like really delicious food.
Yeah. I love all kinds of sausage, but I especially love Lao sausage. What makes it special?
Well, I think traditionally what makes a Lao sausage special is it has tons of herbs in it. It's stuffed with like fat too, like really big chunks of fat. But I think the flavor profile of a Lao sausage is like all over Southeast Asia, lemongrass, galanga, dill, kaffir lime leaf or makrut lime leaf. But yeah, it's such a herbaceous sausage, you know, like you're like, holy crap, it'll hit you. Like, but our sausage is, you know, we took those flavors and we didn't go too traditional with it, but we actually added like a Western twist because we smoke it. So we get it smoked. And the flavors are there, but it's a little different flavor profile because of the smokiness to it. That's, I feel like, what makes that sausage delicious and unique. It's the flavor profile in it.
Yeah, I'm super excited to try it in a few days. So a big part of your operation has always been partnering with like veteran-owned, veteran-supporting businesses. Can you talk about how that is evolving with Uban?
Yeah, so we're only working with one organization right now, and it's actually more of a nonprofit to help war victims in Laos and Vietnam and Cambodia. It's a nonprofit in Wausau, Wisconsin here called We Help War Victims. Jim Harris is the director. He's a former retired principal school teacher, and when he saw like this migration of Hmong and Lao coming into the school system, he's like, what is going on here? Because they don't teach that stuff in the books, especially at that time. And he thought it was his duty to go back, start this nonprofit, go back to Laos, remove bombs, help agriculture over there. So we funnel, by working with these breweries, we give up a portion of proceeds to his nonprofit to help him go back to Laos. Mm-hmm.
And part of this is also taking form in the plates, like the compostable plates.
Yeah.
Can you say more about that?
So Bai Chai is, it means heart leaf in Laos. These leaves, they're palm leaves that fall over Southeast Asia. And they get recycled, they're compostable, you're not cutting down any trees for them. And we were lucky to find a manufacturer to make these for us. So the idea was great. I mean, then we got the product, and they're from Southeast Asia. They're compostable. They fall from trees, so we don't have to cut any trees down. And it's giving back to a good nonprofit that's actually doing good work out there. Versus, like, I've worked with a lot of nonprofits before, and I just kind of saw like the dirty world of them, right? Like, you don't know where the money's going. So we were very cautious on who we chose to funnel these funds to. And Jim, check him out. It's called We Help War Victims. He's out of Wausau. We haven't even launched the company yet, but ultimately it's direct to consumer. You could purchase them on our website once it's launched. But we also use them at our dinners here. And yeah, any other chefs that want to use them as well. I mean, every purchase goes to a good cause.
You've talked about your work as a chef as kind of like a teacher. You want to show people your story, teach them about Lao culture, the story of refugees. Where does that desire come from? Does it come from a place of having been like misunderstood?
Yeah, growing up, you know, you always got the question, like, where's Laos? Who are you? Hmong? Are you this? Are you that? And growing up, I would, you know, I get these questions asked all the time, and it was so unclear to me myself because I was a child. I would talk to my parents about it, and that's when they kind of broke down the war. How they were refugees. Growing up hearing this, you don't really know, because I don't remember that refugee experience, right? I came here very young. But I lost them from, like, why are people so oblivious to what happened, or they don't know anything about it? And it's like, okay, like, the education system's not teaching it. I kind of naturally felt it was my duty to kind of really bring people in through food to tell that story, kind of using food as a medium to explain what happened in Laos in the secret war. But yeah, like growing up, just getting those questions and kind of wondering why people didn't know what happened and why we're here. And, you know, they just assume we're all Asian. So it's like, no, there's a lot of different ethnicities and cultures in Asia. I like to call us the jungle Asians, which is a common term. And, you know, there's just so much ignorance out there, I guess. And you can't even hate people for that, you know, but that's why I do what I do.
Does it ever get tiring?
No, I love talking about it. It's, you know, we just live in a really weird world now where people get offended by so many questions. And I'm just, I want to answer these questions, you know, like I don't think there's any part of me that gets tired of explaining about our mission and our story and our background. What gets tiring is doing these events, like the processes behind it. But no, it doesn't get tiring.
You kind of mentioned this, asking your parents about the story. So I'm curious, like, was it hard to have those conversations? Did your parents talk openly about it, or did you have to kind of like tease it out over the course of, you know, years?
Yeah. So growing up, I always thought they were like fables and like stories, because there's this one story my dad told one time. He was like, we were so poor that we had to eat like rice off the floor. I always thought he was exaggerating, which I'm sure parts of it were. There's this one story where he said, when I was in the war, I had to chop off some guy's ear, and I ate it because I told him, if I see you back, you got one ear. Like, these are the stories that he kind of tried to intimidate me with, which I don't think were true. But one thing they would always tell me was, you don't know how lucky you have it here. how poor they were over there. You know, and that was their thing. It was like reminding us of how privileged we are over here. And you know, my mom still to this day has a bucket of water in her shower just to collect the water from dropping. I'm like, Mom, like, you don't have to do that. You can just shower and use a shower head. But it's growing up and, you know, hearing those stories and seeing them do things differently than, because they thought the world was going to end. So they still live in that survival mode, you know. But seeing those things and hearing those stories, it definitely resonated with me growing up and how we were different, especially living in, you know, rural white America. We were so different than our neighbors.
What does she do with the water? Does she use it water her garden?
Water her garden, wash her hair, like everything. She doesn't want to waste anything, right? She still goes to the food pantry just, I swear she's getting ready for Armageddon again, but she'll like collect food from the food pantry and be like, hey, I got some food for you and your girlfriend. And I'm like, Mom, you do not have to do it. Like, we're good. We don't need like chicken Campbell's soup, you know?
We're very lucky to have our parents.
Yeah, absolutely.
The whole thing with Bite Jai and SAP, it's more than just food, right? I mean, I've done plenty of interviews in the past where it's always the same story. It's telling what happened in Laos. And I, ultimately speaking for all refugees, but that's the closest thing to me, right? Like, why are refugees here? How can we help them? And there's a storyline that goes behind that. What America does is they go into other countries and they create these civil wars and they pull out. And, you know, Viet refugees, Lao refugees are kind of there to fend for themselves. So it's like the ultimate betrayal. But then we come here to a better lifestyle and it's like, okay, like history is so complicated, you know. I've been doing this for 13 years and I want to get better as a company. I want to get better as storyteller, I guess, for lack of better words, but more importantly, like, the focus is the food. You know, if your food tastes like crap, like, no one's gonna listen to you.
Alex Hanasakta is the founder and chef of SAP. He spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran. SAP Uban just released a schedule for April events, and you can find that at WUWM.com. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way. But ahead of that, we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Then listen for new episodes starting in May on Thursdays during Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. Next, we'll speak with the author of a new memoir called Birding to Change the World. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. For educator and activist Trish O'Kane, becoming a birder in Madison brought light to a dark time in life. It also helped her find community and propel social change. When development threatened the city park where her beloved birds lived, O'Kane and her neighbors flocked together to save their home. O'Kane shares her journey and what we can learn from birds in a new memoir called Birding to Change the World. She currently teaches a class under the same name at the University of Vermont. It pairs college students as co-explorers with elementary students. O'Kane joins WUWM's Lena Tran to talk about the new book.
At the end of the book, you write that you really had to live this book before you could start writing it. So what did it look like? When was it time to start this project?
I moved to New Orleans in 2005 to teach journalism at Loyola. I was a human rights investigative journalist for 10 years in Central America. And then I worked at the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama. So my whole background was civil and human rights, not birds. The book really started, we moved to New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina hit in August 29, 2005, 1 month after we'd moved there. I hadn't really thought about environmental issues before that, Lena, to tell you the truth. Only in a very general way. I had never thought about birds. I didn't dislike them. I just never really noticed them. And then Katrina hit. I didn't start writing the book then, but I really started living the book then because I was so distraught, depressed, and angry with myself for how I'd lived because I didn't realize what it meant to live
below sea level in a wetland area. I didn't even know what a wetland was. And that really was the beginning of my journey, standing in the ruins of my home in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina and saying, what am I doing? I had no idea. I wasn't even thinking. I just wanted to live, you know, near the lake so I could walk there. I wasn't thinking about what would happen. And I wasn't thinking about all the poisons I used in my home that ended up in the water.
Yeah. Going from there, what I really appreciate about the entire book is how insistent you are that nature is not separate from us. Like, we're a part of it. It's not a national park. It's like the hill that the kids roll down, and it's the bush in your front yard that has catbirds in it. Why is that frame of mind so crucial?
Well, again, it starts in New Orleans, because I did have that separation in my brain, right? And like, you go to nature, you're going to drive to some beautiful woods where there's no people. But when I stood in the ruins of my home, I mean, nature literally, the water was in our home for 3 weeks, because we had a home that was about 12 feet tall, and it filled with 11.5 feet of water in the bowl, what New Orleanians call the bowl, for 3 weeks. So nature was in my living room, my kitchen, my bathroom. That's when the wall in my brain began to break down. And also, I realized how I lived in my home was impacting fish and creatures all around me, and microscopic creatures I didn't even know existed. I decided I wanted to learn more about that. So I moved to Madison, Wisconsin to get a PhD in environmental science, environmental studies. Then the wall in my brain began to really fall down, because we moved across the street from Madison's Warner Park, which is the largest urban park. In that urban park, which is half fully developed, I don't even like that word, but built up, right? Buildings, sports, lights, pavement. And the other half is about 100 acres of wild, scruffy stuff. I noticed that the animals were everywhere. They weren't just on the wild, scruffy side. Their red-tailed hawks were flying around the baseball stadium during baseball games. And the fox was taking a nap on a sunny afternoon on the tennis court. So the animals, and going into this park every day as part of my nature therapy healing after Katrina, the animals taught me that this barrier is false, that this separation is totally false.
Yeah. And there's this moment when you're first looking at the plan for development in Warner Park, and you imagine migrating birds flying over the park, wondering where their home went. And you write that you really knew how that feels because you saw this aerial photo of your home after Katrina. And it's a really powerful moment of like intra-species empathy. I'm wondering how you think we could stretch that muscle.
That's really the goal of my book. Well, first of all, I was very depressed after Katrina. And then I got to Madison. I was still depressed, but starting to get better. I started going into this park every day across the street. I took ornithology and I started doing my homework in the park. And the minute I set foot in that park, it was better than drugs. So the intraspecies empathy for me came from gratitude. I became addicted to that park and the birds, and I was so grateful to them. And then when I discovered the city plan to build up the park even further and put pontoon boats in the wetland where the birds nested, also clear a woods and pave parts of the meadow. And I mean, all this crazy stuff was going to destroy all the birds' homes. That's when I said, wait a minute, I've been birding in here for 2 years and the birds have literally saved my life. What am I going to do about this? Their homes are about to be destroyed. So for me, interspecies empathy came from deep grief and then healing through nature, which has been proven in over 100 public health studies, that nature can help mental health and physical health. And these are my friends. I'm not just studying them. I began to study them. I did do a geolocation mapping study of catbirds in Madison. And I did a 360-page dissertation, and I found 141 bird species. I did a baseline ornithology survey. So I did the science, but I felt, these are my friends. They have saved my life. What am I going to do about them? Because they're going to go to Latin America or the south of the United States for the winter, and they're going to come back in the spring, and their homes are going to be gone. And I didn't know what to do, but I talked to neighbors, and we got together, and we stopped the concretization of Warner Park.
Yeah. You kind of use that intraspecies empathy, and it motors just this civic engagement, your activism over many years, you know, the idea of birding to change the world becomes very literal when we learn that you've had students who have like protested and written op-eds. I'm wondering, like, what is it about birds that motors civic engagement?
Well, first of all, they're accessible. They're beautiful. They're funny. They're everywhere. I think, you know, I've been involved in activists as a community activist since for, you know, 20, 30 years in different issues since college. I don't think rage and fear are sustainable fuels. I've burned out. Many people burned out. And I've discovered that birds for me were sustainable fuel for my soul and renewable, because I'd go out one day, I'd see the birds, and I'd go to public meetings that night and we'd fight and I'd be discouraged and my husband and I would yell at each other and our neighbors, we'd get together. But I knew the next morning I could go back into Warner Park and the catbirds would be there, or the hermit thrushes would be there, or the brown thrasher would be singing in the morning, or the great blue heron was going to fly over Sled Hill right when I was sitting up there at 7 a.m. So the birds were always there for me. And that motor, I mean, it wasn't just a motor, they were there. And they still are there, even in bigger numbers now. Warner Park is a major birding hotspot today in Madison, because we stopped the largest fireworks show in the Midwest, Rhythm and Booms. People in Milwaukee will have heard of this, because they were blowing up the wetland nursing grounds of the birds in Warner Park. We stopped it. And now there are eagles nesting on a former fireworks trash launch pad.
As someone that was new to academia, and specifically science academia, did you get any like pushback or skepticism from people that like so much of your work and research was like coming from a place of community organizing and activism?
Yes, I did. Well, I was very lucky, Lena. It wasn't luck. When I was sitting in New Orleans after this, you know, 6 months after Katrina, saying, I can't stay here, what am I going to do? And I Googled like activist, professor, environment. Up pops Dr. Jack Kloppenberg, an environmental sociologist born and raised in Milwaukee, who taught at that time at UW-Madison. I emailed him and I got an email back like the next day. And I said, I'm in New Orleans. I'm a mess, but I have this background and I don't even know what I want to do my PhD work on, but I need to get out of here. Can you help me? I get an email from the guy like the next day saying, yes, I can help you. You have to get accepted first. Call me. Let's talk. He became one of my dearest friends. And I chose him because he had an activist background. He worked in the community gardening movement. And he is really one of the founders of the whole idea of the food shed and, you know, people thinking of the local food movement. So when I went to him, I did not think, Lena, that I was going to do this for my PhD. I was just trying to do it as a citizen. And then I realized, you know what, I can't be a full-time just PhD student and be a researcher at the university, full-time job to pay the bills and tuition and all that, and do full-time organizing. I can't do it. So I didn't know what to do. I was kind of going to give up. And I had to talk scheduled with Jack, my PhD advisor. 3 years in, I still didn't know what I was going to write my dissertation about. I was dreading it because I do not like academic writing. I'm not good at it. And I just thought, you know what? I'm just going to tell this guy the whole truth. And I did. And he said, this is your dissertation.
Throughout the book, you point out all these different lessons in bird behavior and how we can learn from them. What bird behaviors would you love to see humans adopt?
Well, I start the book, as you know, with one of those behaviors called murmuration. Starlings have this amazing behavior. And if you've seen them in cities swirling around doing this prayer dance, I start the book with that because there has been an amazing 18-year study in Rome done by Dr. Andrea Cavagna, and I interviewed him because he wanted to know, how do the starlings turn together? How do they communicate so they don't all crash into each other? And there could be millions of them doing it. And so he spent 18 years on top of a museum in downtown Rome at sunset with 3D photography, photographing the starlings as they came swirling into their roosts, and discovered that one starling turns, usually because it sees a predator like a hawk coming, and seven starlings right around it. They can see out of their peripheral vision that bird turning, and they turn with it. And every one of those birds affects seven more. It's a physics law of seven.
I'd like to see us emulate that behavior. Now, Dr. Cavagna pointed out to me that that's a romantic notion, but we could have a murmuration. If we could see, as the starlings see a hawk coming as a predator, if we could see climate change as a predator coming for us right now and start to make that turn, we could change history. So I believe in the power of the small and that one turning and then the seven. And I tell my students, you don't have to impact hundreds or thousands of people. Let's start with seven.
Trish O'Kane is the author of the new memoir, Birding to Change the World. She spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Nadia Kelly, Mayan Silver, Emily Files, and Taryn Powell from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon for a look at how a local union's work in the Deer District could serve as a model for service and hospitality industries. Plus, we'll explore Wisconsin's political landscape post-spring election in Capitol Notes. Thanks so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.